out to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical, grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
7 is one of those passages that cause such great problems. Paul is dealing with marriage. But there are two reasons why it's so difficult to interpret this chapter. And I want you to think with me before you just pick this up and try to apply it to 20th century America. Number one, there is a real problem at Corinth. We don't know what it is. Persecution from Rome, persecution from pagans, persecution from Jews, a unique situation there, but there's a problem at Corinth. And Paul is speaking to that problem in that day, not just sitting down talking about universal theology. Number two, chapter 7 begins the section of 1 Corinthians where Paul is answering specific questions that the church at Corinth wrote to him. We find those in chapter 7, verse 1, verse 25, 8, 1, 12, 1, 16, 1. But we don't know what questions they ask him. We can just summarize. So we need to take into account the cultural situation at Corinth, the crisis situation at Corinth, and we're not certain what questions they ask. There was two kinds of problems here I've talked to you last week on. There was those who thought that if it feels good, do it. Their bumper sticker would have been that. And those who thought if it feels good, don't do it. Paul's trying to walk the tightrope, theologically and practically, between those two extremist groups in this church. Okay, let's begin then. Now, I take up the matters about which you wrote me. There's that little phrase in Greek that I repeat so often. It may be a good thing for a man to remain unmarried. Now, that may be a quote from this letter they wrote him. Paul may be saying there's an element of truth in what you say. You know, heresy is nothing more than one truth lifted up to the exclusion of all other truth. Why would Paul say it may be a good thing for a man to remain unmarried? Now, it says literally not to touch a woman. What does that mean? Does that mean that marriage is a sin? That celibacy is a better thing than marriage? Well, I think for Paul, Paul said that celibacy is a state that if you can handle it because of God's spiritual gift, you'll get more accomplished for the kingdom of God. I think he's going to state that. But you can't read the whole Bible and get marriage is anything but God's will. You can't read Genesis 2, even in Paul, Ephesians 5, and many other beautiful passages. Marriage is not only is honorable, it's appropriate, it's God's gift, it's the norm. So be careful you don't read a disparaging comment on marriage in here because it's not meant to be. All right? But because of so much sexual immorality, every man should have a wife of his own. Now, this seems like a just permission, but this is an imperative. This is a specific command. Not that we should, we must. Every man should have a wife of his own. It's talking about the norm. Okay? Now, and every woman a husband her own. The husband must always give his wife what is due her. That's a present imperative. Now, you see, in our day, this seems very negative. But in Paul's day, where there was such an overbalance on the part of men's rights, what men could do, Paul's going to bring a balance here, just like he does in Ephesians 5, 22 through 6, 9. He is speaking to a culture that's unbalanced, and he's bringing the underdog up to a place of rights and responsibility. Now, I think the universal principle that's going to be found throughout this chapter, and I'm going to give you the verses now before I get into it. Verse 8, verse 17, verse 20, verse 24, verse 40. Paul's going to say, stay as you are. That's what he's in light of the current situation. It's not good to touch a woman, not to get married, is what he's saying. In light of the problems we're facing right now at Corinth, in light of the present crisis, don't get married now. That's what he's saying. But if you are married, the husband has rights, the wife has rights. Do you see both these extreme elements asking questions from different directions? Now, notice that husbands and wives must stop refusing each other. Sex is not to be a tool to control one's mate. This also seems to refute asceticism that says no sex makes one more holy. Paul rejects that throughout. Sex is honorable. Sex is good. Sex is normal. Sex is God's plan. Now, notice it says, except you agree to do so for a little while so as to have plenty of time for prayer. You know, I think when it says, talks about two agree, and that may be husband and wife. Friends, I think that our physical lives, sexually and every other way, affect our spiritual lives. Now, the word fasting is not in the best Greek manuscripts here. Is it possible so as to keep Satan from tempting you, present tense, because of your lack of self-control? You mean even in a married condition, Satan can tempt two married couples sexually? Yes. We must be careful that we're not tools or pawns or objects to each other, but we are two Christians in a relationship together with Christ. Now, verse 6, but I say this by way of concession, not by way of command. What? Is he referring to verses 2 through 5, verses 3 and 4, verse 5 by itself? I think he's referring to verse 5, saying you don't have to separate for prayer, but if you do, I'm saying this by way of concession, not by way of command. I think it goes with that. It's real hard to know. Okay. However, from verse 7, I should like for everyone to be just as I am myself. Now, what does that mean? Single or self-controlled? Well, I think Paul was married. I don't think he was saying never marry, because I think Jewish pressure on a young rabbi would force him to marry just because of God's command, be fruitful and multiply. Rabbis would marry just to fulfill God's command, whether they love someone or not. And it was a real oddity for an unmarried rabbi. So I think Paul probably was married. Another evidence is in Acts 26:10, where it says he cast his vote against Christians, which seems to imply that Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin. If he was, you couldn't be a member without being married. Paul's wife either died, or when he became a Christian, she left him. I think he understood what singleness was all about. Now, yet each of us has his own special gift from God, one for one way, another for another. Now, what this is saying is celibacy a spiritual gift? Yeah, I think it is. Is marriage a spiritual gift? Yes, I think it is. We're not saying one's better than the other. We're just saying because of practical considerations, because of the current problems, not to be married is better. Why? Well, you know, I want to think that I could resist temptation and torture for Christ's sake. But friends, I want to tell you, I'm not real sure you get my little five-year-old boy, start hurting him, what I'd do. It'd be easy, I think, to die for Christ by myself compared with watching my children and wife. So I think, practically speaking, it's easier to be single in a lot of ways if you have the gift of celibacy. I'm going to deal with this special gift in chapter 12 through 14, which is the definitive passage in all the New Testament on spiritual gifts. I'm going to wait till then to get into all of that. By the way, the word special gift is the word charisma. Charisma. Charis, grace. It means gift. That's the root for spiritual gift. To unmarried people and to widows, I would say this. It would be a fine thing for them to remain single as I am. But if, first-class conditional sense, they do not practice self-control, middle voice verb used with athletes in training, let them marry. Aorist imperative. Marry. For it is better to marry, aorist, than to be burning in a fire of passion. Now, people said, oh, this is disparaging. Paul's just making marriage. If you can't handle it, get married. Well, I want to tell you, I don't mind burning passionately, sexually. God's created me that way. I don't have the gift of sex. There's nothing wrong in burning passionately, sexually. God made us that way. I don't think it's a disparaging comment at all here. To the people already married, I give this instruction. No, not I, but the Lord. Now, what Paul's going to do through here, when he can, he's going to quote Jesus himself. And here, Jesus is going to quote about that a wife is not to leave her husband. He goes back to Matthew 5:32, Matthew 19:6, Mark 10:11-12, Luke 16:18. He's going to quote Jesus. And a little bit down in verse 12, he's not going to be able to quote Jesus. He says, I myself give my opinion, not the Lord. That's not going to be a disparaging comment on inspiration. It's going to be saying, I don't have any words of Jesus to quote in this matter. Now, up here about divorce, there is something to quote. Divorce is out of the will of God. Divorce is always a sin. Divorce is always a problem. Now, I know there's a lot of divorced people, and I love them. God bless them. I hope they find a good Christian and settle down. But I want you to know, after divorce, it's always a reclamation project of grace. Divorce is not God's will for believers. That's the ideal, and we must hold it up. Now, when it says, verse 11, but if, that's the third class conditional potential action, but if she does leave him, he must remain single or better to be reconciled. Aorist passive imperative by an outside agent once and for all to her husband. I instruct the husband to not to divorce his wife. Now, there are some exceptions. Unchastity in Matthew 5:32, 19:9. This idea about being married to an unbeliever in this same chapter, verses 12 and 13. It's not a hard and fast rule with no exceptions. You know, someone called me and said he's about to kill me and the kids. Man, I say get out of the house. Now, it's the difference between saying get out of the house and getting a divorce. Biblically, I'm not sure we have the grounds for divorce and remarriage, though we may have the grounds for separation. Now, I live in a tension here I want to share with you briefly. If someone comes to me point blank and says, Pastor, does the Bible teach remarriage after divorce? I must say, no, I don't believe it does. But if someone comes to me and say, Bob, will you remarry us? Will you marry us? We've been divorced, but we want a Christian home. Will you marry us? I say, yes, I will. I've told the Lord that I'm willing to stand before Him for going against what I know is a problem, but that I'd rather pick people than hard and fast rules, and I'll take whatever's coming to me when I stand before Him. I don't feel comfortable with that, but I do it because of my belief in the grace of God. I may be in trouble. Verse 12, to the rest of the people, I myself would say, though the Lord Himself has said nothing about it. Now, this is not Paul saying, I'm not speaking under inspiration. If you read verse 25 and verse 40, he says, I am under inspiration. He's just saying, this is something the Lord hadn't spoken about, so I'm going to give you my opinion. If a Christian has a wife that is not a believer and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband that is not a believer and he consents to live with her must not divorce her husband. Now, what is this talking about? Well, I think it's saying not that a believer can marry a non-believer. We're not talking about that at all. If two unbelievers, one of which becomes converted, what does one do? Well, here, look at what it says. For the unbelieving husband is consecrated by union with his wife, and the unbelieving wife by union with her Christian husband. For otherwise, your children would be unblessed, but in this way, they are consecrated. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about this. Does this mean that the unbelieving spouse of a Christian is saved? Some have said that. Or does it mean that children of a home where one of them is a Christian, the children are saved? Well, this has been used as a proof text for infant baptism. But the same relation exists between the unbelieving spouse that believes with the children. There's a whole lot of theories. I personally believe that one Christian in the home makes an impact on the lifestyle of the whole home, on the atmosphere of the whole home, on the attitude of the whole home. And I think that's what it's referring about, and we can't use the proof text for baptizing our kids. Now, but if the unbelieving consort actually leaves, he leaves himself or herself, let the separation stand. In such cases, the Christian husband or wife is not morally bound, perfect passive. This has been quoted as a proof text for remarriage. It's just saying you don't have to work on the relationship, you can let it terminate. That's what it's saying, I think. God has called us to live in peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? This has been interpreted radically different by Christians. Some say, quote 1 Peter 3:1-12, and say, hang in there, you may be the one to win your unbelieving spouse. But the context seems to say, don't be in a bad situation just for the hope of evangelism when it may not happen. God's called us to peace in our homes. Not current continual fiction in unlove and abuse. So either side can be the way it is. I think it's, I don't know which it is. Now in verse 17, for everybody must continue to live or walk, literally, in the station which the Lord has assigned him. There's the universal principle. 17, 20, 24, 26, 40, and alluded to in verse 8. Stay as you are. Stay as you are. Paul makes some exceptions through here, but the major thrust is stay as you are. Circumcision is an example. Slavery is an example. Marriage is an example. All examples of this universal principle. These are my orders to all the churches. Has a man been called after he was circumcised? He must not try to change it. Change it? How do you change being circumcised? Well, you know, this is a present middle imperative, by the way. Young Jewish boys who were circumcised could have a surgical operation performed on them where they would look like they weren't. We find a reference to it in 1 Maccabees 1:15. Paul says circumcision is not what matters. Look at verse 19. Being circumcised or not being circumcised has no value. See Romans 2, 28, 29, Galatians 5, 6, and 6, 15. Now, Paul, this is something God commanded in the Old Testament. Paul is laying the Old Testament ritual aside as not being the way to approach God. It's not whether you're Jew or Greek anymore. It's whether you know Christ. That's the real key, and that's what he's getting to. Now, notice where it says, but keeping God's command is important. And doesn't that sound prophetic? It's not ritual. It's attitude. It's obedience. That's what Paul's saying here. Everybody must remain in the station which he was called. Present imperative. Command. Continual command. You were called while a slave. Stop letting that annoy you. Yet if you can win your fellowship, take advantage of such an opportunity. Win your freedom. Now, the Greek text here is very ambiguous. It literally says, rather use. Now, some have said that means if you can do it, it's aorist imperative. If you can get your freedom, get it. But that doesn't seem to fit the whole context, which is stay as you are. But maybe it does mean that because he's just made an allowance for a believer in a marriage relationship with an unbeliever. Maybe he's making an allowance for a slave who has an opportunity to get out of that. But the general context says stay where you are. So I'm not sure which way that really goes. For the slave who has been called in union with the Lord is the Lord's freedman. In the same way, the freedman who has been called is a slave of Christ. You have been bought and actually paid for. Stop becoming slaves to men. Present middle imperative. We don't belong to men. We belong to Christ. If we're a slave, we're to serve as if we were serving Christ, even though the masters may be ugly to us. See Ephesians 6. Now, notice where it continues then. Brothers, each one must continue close to God in the very station in which he has been called. There's that universal principle again. About unmarried women, verse 25, it's the same little phrase that is another question the Corinthian Christians were asking. I have no command from the Lord, but I'll give you my opinion as one who is trustworthy since I've had mercy shown me by the Lord. Paul said, Lord didn't speak on this, but I'll tell you my opinion. I'm spirit-filled and I'm under inspiration and I'm an apostle. I'll tell you what I think. Now, this is my opinion in light of the present crisis, distress. We don't know what that is. Was it local? Was it temporary? Was it pagan culture? Was it the immorality at Corinth? I don't know. That is a good thing for a man to remain as he is. I do not believe that's a universal principle. Christianity wouldn't last long if none of us got married and had kids, unless we did some heck of an evangelism job. I want to tell you, this is not a universal principle. It's a reaction to the situation in Corinth. Are you married? Are you unmarried? Two perfect tenses. Stop trying to get a divorce. Stop looking for a wife. Present imperatives with may articles means stop and act already in process. They were divorcing. They were looking for new wives. But if, third class conditional potential action, you get married, you have not sinned in doing so. And if a girl gets married, she's not sinned in doing so. But those who do will have trouble in this earthly life, and I'm trying to spare you. It's harder with a family. You're more tied to earthly things. Now, verses 29 down through about 31. What is that saying? The tie has been cut short. Well, Calvin said it meant that human life was short. I think it means that our opportunity for Christian service is short. Some think it means that the closeness to the second coming. But what it's saying is that we must see the priority of spiritual things. We don't break our relationship with normal earthly things. We just don't make them ultimate. And you ought to read 29 down there. It's not saying get out of the world. It's saying stay in the world, but don't make worldly ties the ultimate priority of your life. Now, in the last part of verse 31, it says, for the outer order of this world is passing away. Friends, this world's not evil. It's just transitory. It's not the problem. It's just not ultimate. Okay? I'm kind of running out of time. Let me go to verse 35. For it is your welfare that I am saying this, not to put a restraint on you, animal halter, but to foster good order and to help you have an undivided devotion to the Lord. That's what all of us want, that kind of thing. Now, verse 36 really caused some problems. Mine has, now if, first class conditional, assumed true, a father thinks that he is going to do the proper thing regarding his single daughter. Now, the literal Greek here is a man, a virgin. There have been three major interpretations. Number one, this is a father and his unmarried daughter. That's what Williams' translation has. Number two, that it's a man and his fiancée. the Goodspeed Translation and Revised Standard Version, that it's referring to a spiritual marriage where two people live together, sleep in the same bed, but never have sex, which occurred in Corinth in the 2nd century. It was to show their strength. It's called a spiritual marriage. And that's what the New English Bible and the Moffat Translation seem to imply this is. It's very unusual to call a daughter his virgin. And a little later on, it's going to say, let them marry. Plural. I think it's a man and his fiance. I don't think it's a daddy saying my daughter can't marry. Let's go through it. Now, if a father thinks that he has done the proper thing regarding his single daughter, if she is past the bloom of her youth. Now, the literal there is a little bit different, and it could be translated something to do with the man. She ought to do so. Literally, it means so ought to be what the one wishes. Very neutral. Could be the man as well as the woman. Let them do, that's a present imperative, what she desires. Again, it's hard with the pronouns to know if it's the man or the wife, or the girl. He commits no sin. Now, mine has, let the daughter and her suitor marry. No, literally it says, let them marry, present imperative. I think it's a man and his fiance. I think what's happening is two people were going to get married. Paul wrote this letter. They don't know what to do. They say, should we get married or not? Paul said, don't. Paul says, if you have the gift of celibacy, don't marry. There's a lot of problems coming. It'd be better if you didn't. If you don't have that gift, y'all marry. It'll be fine. God will be with you. It'll be more problems, but God will be with you. If you're married, you know that. Marriage is a hassle. It's a great joy. It's also a hassle. A lot more problems tied up with that. A lot more joy, I think, tied up with that. But you can see Paul, in a time of persecution and pressure, being single was a better thing. Not universal principle. Local. Let's see. Verse 38. And so the man who gives his daughter in marriage does what is right, and yet the man who does not do so does even better because of the current crisis. Verse 39. A wife is bound, perfect tense, to her husband as long as he lives. If husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she pleases. Here again, remarriage isn't a problem. Remarriage is fine in this situation. There's nothing sinful about remarriage at all. Except he must be a Christian. Now, there's two possible interpretations. He must be a Christian goes along with 2 Corinthians 6:14. I think it's inappropriate for a growing Christian to marry anybody less than another growing Christian. But the Greek here can mean she must act as a Christian, which implies the same thing. But anyway. But in my opinion, she'll be happier if she remains as she is. Now, the widow's role in 1 Timothy was widows over 60 years old. Paul told the younger widows to remarry. I think widow role and deaconess is the same thing. Paul encourages young widows to remarry. Nothing wrong with that. Now, but I think, too, that I have God's Spirit. Now, here's the affirmation back from verse 12 and 25 that Paul is saying, look, I'm Spirit-filled. I'm Spirit-led. This is what I see. I'm an apostle. Take note. Well, I hope you'll go back and read chapter 7 as a unit and see how it deals with issues in its own day. Be careful not to apply this to our day until you've taken the time to find out what it meant to the people in Corinth in the first century, and then take the universal truths and apply it to our day. I want to show you a book that's really been a help to me. This is on Paul's theology. I don't agree with all this man says, but it is so good. Paul, An Outline of His Theology by Hermann Ritterboss. He's a German man. This is translated into English. It's extensively indexed. If you notice in the back, just page after page of indexed. Let me give you an idea here. I mark my books by a red dot. You may have another system, but mark this. Take the index in the back and put it in your reference Bible by every verse this man speaks to. And I want to tell you, this guy will bless your heart. He has really brought Paul's theology together for me in a unique way. This is something, if you want a good gift for your pastor or someone who really loves the Bible, this is a good gift. I've enjoyed being with you. I hope to see you next time. God bless you.